Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and creative entrepreneur, bringing you interviews, inspiration, and information on writing, publishing options, and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free author blueprint, and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 424 of the podcast. And it's Friday, 29th of March, 2019, as I record this. So today I'm talking to Jeff Simon on autopsies for authors. And Jeff is a federal forensic investigator. So this is fascinating. If you write crime, or actually we talk about writing autopsies in other niches like paranormal or sci-fi fantasy type things, which is really interesting. But also it's just fascinating to talk to someone who works in a very different area to many of us. So I hope you enjoy that interview coming up. In my personal update, I wanted to talk a bit about Ian McKellen, the actor, and we saw his 80th birthday show this week at the theatre here in Bath. And what is absolutely incredible, first of all, you probably know Ian McKellen. He was Gandalf in Lord of the Rings. He's been Magneto in X-Men, and of course has had a career as an actor on the stage in Britain and other places. And his 80th birthday show, I mean, the guy is incredible. He's doing, it must be 30 or maybe more sessions around Britain at lots of the theatres that mean something to him in his career. And it was a fascinating show because it was a one-man show. It was about 3 hours, and which just shows you how much energy he has because he does it night after night, which of course is what actors do. But I was very impressed with his stamina. But it struck me, he talks about how much he has loved the stage since he was a kid. He talks about being taken to the theatre at age 3 to something or other, I can't remember what it was, but seeing, sort of wondering how things were done, how did things work? I think it was Peter Pan, because he said he could see the strings and wanted to know who was holding the strings and how it worked. And what was just lovely was how much he obviously still loves the stage and acting, because why would you do that for your 80th birthday otherwise? And he mentions a lot of, you know, the famous people that we know that he sort of grew up with in the stage. And that was interesting to me as well, because there's this idea of the seniors. I can't remember who coined the term. Actually, I've just looked it up, and in fact, seniors is a term coined by musician and producer Brian Eno. And essentially, it's talking about a group of people and a situation that enables things to arise. And it made me also think about, so each individual, I guess, is less important than the whole. And although certain personalities may emerge from that seniors, it's the group together that makes it stronger. And that also made me think about the indie world and how we do, I think, have this seniors, this group who push each other forward. And so I was also, again, sort of reflecting on Ian McKellen, and this quote came, I keep this quote and I make sure it pops up on my notes every now and then, by Elizabeth Gilbert from Big Magic. She says, "Measure your worth by your dedication to your path, not by your successes or failures." And yeah, I think that also strikes me when I think about Ian McKellen and other people in their 80s, 70s and 80s who are still working, who still love what they do, because that's what I want to be doing as well. And certainly this dedication to your path, that's the thing that will keep you going, because the success and the failures, these are momentary. They are fleeting. And so you have to enjoy the path. You have to enjoy the journey. Otherwise, you'll just go nuts. So I just wanted to mention that. Also, I am back into Map of Shadows this week. I realized, I mean, I know this every time, it's so funny how the creative circle happens, because every time you hit the same things, and what you need to realize is that it's a normal part of your creative process. But what happens to me, because I'm a discovery writer mainly, I do have a few ideas as to what happens at the end, but mostly I'm a discovery writer. Even though I've tried many times to try and be a plotter, I am not. I am a pantser. So I usually hit a wall at around 30,000 words of a full-length novel, and I lose the plot. I completely lose the plot. I'm like, okay, I don't know what is happening here. And what I have to do is go back and find the strands of the characters, work out my open loops. And if you don't know what an open loop is, it's basically how we do cliffhangers, or, you know, you plant half of the information in someone's head and then, or a question, and then they want to know what happens next. So for example, you know, she pushed open the door and gasped at what was inside. You want to know what's inside now. That's like an open loop. And then, of course, you can have different layers of open loops for each of your characters. And that's how a book moves forward. And you open all of these. And then at some point you have to close them all. And I think what happens is I get to a point and I realize I've opened so many loops and now I have to close them. So I have spent a bit of time going back through, and I don't edit at this stage. I wasn't editing, but I printed out what I had and kind of wrote down next to it, did some notes on my open loops so that I now know how to tackle the next part of the book. So yeah, also, I guess, saggy middle and all of that. But yes, I am back into Map of Shadows. Also, I decided I deserve a break. So normally what I do is I'll write my first draft and then I will book another trip. But my 10-year anniversary show a couple of weeks ago really reminded me that I work super hard. I work hard. I've been working pretty hard for 10 years now, more than 10 years on this career. And yes, I travel a lot, but last year I traveled a lot for work. And that's part of why I've stopped speaking this year, but it made me realise that I need to go on another trip because I'm going a little bit bonkers. So as this goes out, I will be in Amsterdam, which is cool. And I've been to Amsterdam before, but I've been wanting to write a book about it for a while. So I am naughtily, and this is naughty for me, I normally make sure I have a draft before I start planting seeds for the next book. But I really just want, it's tulip season and I love tulips. So I want to go and see the tulips in Amsterdam and amongst other things. If you know the Vrolijk Museum, if you're into anatomy museums as I am, then I'll be going to the Vrolijk. And of course, you can follow my pictures on Instagram at jfpenauthor. That's where I put my pictures. And what else did I was thinking? I've been thinking about a lot of things this week, clearly. I listened to the interview with Michael Anderley on the self-publishing show, or the SPF self-publishing formula podcast, episode 164. Now, that also tied into what I was thinking about around Ian McKellen. And Michael is well known as the founder of the 20 Books to 50K Facebook group and the conference with Craig Martell. And I really urge you to listen to the interview because, first of all, there's a bit of an insight into London Book Fair as James and Mark talk about that. But also, Michael talks about the publishing company that he runs now, one that releases more books than many publishers in the UK, like as in Michael's company is now bigger than a lot of these. Well, it's moving faster. Let's call it that. He mentions releasing, I think, 24 or 25 books a month right now, with more to come, and many of which are in the same worlds. So, using the rapid release model. And this is what I talked about last year when I said we cannot keep up as individual authors. You cannot keep up with collectives like this or publishing companies like this. So, but I wonder, it made me really think about the distinctions that happen as people move, become more successful in quotation marks. And this is where your definition of success is so important, because there is a point where you have to decide, are you an indie author? Are you an author? Do you love the writing? Do you love the actual creation? Or are you a publisher? Do you use other people to publish your books? And I think this is part of what kind of came up in the copy paste Chris discussion. Discussion furore around plagiarism and then a deeper discussion on using ghostwriters, because those of us who love the creation process don't really understand why you would use a ghostwriter, because we love the writing. And even though it's hard, like I said, I'm struggling with Map of Plagues, but I still love the process. I want to write my own books. And in fact, the co-writing that I was doing, I just wasn't enjoying that. So I stopped doing it. I definitely urge you to listen to that interview with Michael, because it's a classic move from author to publisher. And Michael says they want to have even more books published every month, and he has some very clear goals. You have to admire the guy's ambition. But when you listen to that, that's when you have to choose what business model you want. And at London Book Fair, a lot of people asked me about this business model of rapid release. And I said to people, and KU, which, as you know, I'm a proponent of wide publishing. But I said, you know, you can only follow people whose business model you want to emulate. And you know, you can be doing rapid release and still learn something from me, I'm sure, but my business model looks nothing like that. And so the other person I've been thinking about again is Pat Flynn of the Smart Passive Income. And it makes me laugh because his podcast tagline is, "It's all about working hard now so you can sit back and reap the benefits later." But of course, Pat has a multi seven figure company, and Michael Anderley has, you know, certainly seven figures, multi seven figures. And the question is, what is later? When do you reap the benefits? And to me, reaping the benefits is heading off to Amsterdam to see the tulips. So it's so interesting to me, because I used to think I was ambitious, but now I think I'm ambitious around creative projects, not necessarily around business growth. This ties back to the Company of One interview I did with Paul Jarvis in episode 413, which questions the idea of growth. And I agree with Paul, you know, I don't want employees. I don't want to, you know, the business income, it's interesting. Our business now, the Creative Pen, it's really evened out. It's not growing in terms of revenue. It's a stable, mature business. And I could grow, but I would need more employees. I could grow, but I don't want to work all the time. I could write more books, but I like the pace I work at. I want more joy, more creation, more travel. And of course, now I've got my new show, Books and Travel, and that will make money at some point, but it won't for a few years. But I'm enjoying the process. And I actually had some comments saying that I sound more me. Lynn left a comment saying, "What I find fascinating is coming back to listen to you on the Creative Pen after listening to the episodes so far on Books and Travel. I definitely feel closer to Joe Francis," because I'm Joe Francis on the other show, "than I do to Joanna. Read closer as meaning I can detect more of the real you coming out in the Books and Travel podcast. If this is your intention, this revealing more of yourself, it's definitely working." And yes, it is my intention. And I replied to Lynn and said, you know, I am both of these people, but I have worked very hard to build up a stable business so that perhaps I can be more me in my next endeavor. So yeah, very exciting. So I just, you know, reflecting on the question for you, and wherever you are, you might not be at the six-figure, multi-six-figure heading further place, but the main question is, what is your goal? Because I see people who have set goals and then they seem to blast past those goals and the goalposts are moving further and further away all the time. And the question is about life. How do you want your life to look? How do you want your business model to look? How do you define success? And how will you know when you reach it? So, and if you do reach it, what will you do next? So I think for me, at the moment, the creative pen is where I wanted it to be. And now I can start doing other things because I just love the creation process. That is so me. So yeah, don't expect me to be creating a publishing company. That's not happening. Right, in useful stuff. And this is a classic case of people who have different business models, because I am not someone who enjoys analyzing data, analyzing Amazon. But luckily, the wonderful Alex Newton from Klytics is a data geek and loves analyzing it. And I very much enjoy his reports from Klytics and his data analysis, because even though I don't enjoy it myself, I definitely enjoy using the data. And even though I publish wide, obviously I like to optimize Amazon. So one of the most popular webinars I did last year was with Alex from Klytics, and we are going to do it again with updated material because of course Alex is permanently looking at data, and I don't think he ever takes a day off. And in this webinar, you will discover how to identify categories that will work for your books, saving you time and helping you sell more. And also how to resolve the issues presented by Amazon's latest changes to its category display. Remember, you used to be able to scroll down to the bottom of the page and find the categories you're in or other books and then kind of just copy that. Well, you can't do that anymore, but Alex has a way to resolve that, plus special tips and tricks that he's going to share just with us. And Alex is always full of new things. So I'm super excited about this webinar. I am super grateful to have smart friends who are happy to share. And you can join us on this free webinar, Thursday, 11th of April, 2 p.m. US Eastern, 7 p.m. UK. Or you can register and get the replay. You can sign up at thecreativepen.com/11April. So 11April. And that's not case sensitive. So thecreativepen.com/11April. And yeah, that will be fun. So thanks for all your emails and tweets this week. Damon Swade was a massive hit, as I knew he would be. And if you get a chance to hear him speak in person, and he does speak all over the US and all over the world, in fact, definitely go. He is an excellent speaker. And of course, you all enjoyed his interview. So just a few of the tweets and comments. Tracy Devlin says, really love this podcast with Joe and Damon. They both bring so much positive energy to a conversation. Thanks, Damon, for rejuvenating my love for words. In a world of go, 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 it's easy to lose the essence of novel writing. Kate Minchin says, another superb episode. Great to listen to as I walk into San Diego to carry out interviews for my next book. Damon certainly has a diverse and energizing verbal palette. Yes, he does. Roy Huff says, this was an amazing episode. I bought the pre-release of Activate right after listening. I haven't been this excited for a release in some time. And yes, I bought Activate too. And if it is available for pre-order, or it might be out now by the time you get this. And what else? Oh, Tara Jade Brown says, if you need a mental Red Bull for today, listen to the intro of the latest Creative Pen podcast. If I wasn't an author already, I would want to become one listening to her talk. Thank you, Tara. And it's so funny because, of course, I have transcripts of the interview on the blog, but I don't do transcripts of this intro. This is just for you guys, and most of it's made up on the spot. I have some notes, but it's not reading it or anything. So I'm going to have to go listen to it myself because I can't remember what I said. a lovely one from Cheryl says, I've been incommunicado, but this interview from Damon Swade has knocked me well out of my malaise. I feel I want to read this 50 times until it's in my DNA, which is fantastic. And then finally, Eileen Omosa says, I can predict my next week. I will learn something new from Joanna's podcast. Today, I learned about Street Lib and books in Africa. I went to their website and returned with more questions. That's where my learning begins. And I was so pleased with this tweet. Thank you, Eileen, and also for checking out Street Lib. I have on my to-do list to start publishing my nonfiction there in particular. But This is what I want to do for you guys with this podcast. I want to give you new places to jump off and discover new things. That is exactly what I want this show to be and to continue being over time. So thank you for that. Right, today's show is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and talking of wide distribution, and I will play a word from them in a minute. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, transcription and editing, but my time in creating the show is sponsored by my patrons. So thanks to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. Thanks to new patrons, Peter Lacey, Joy Suzanne Hunt, Daniel Martone. Hi, Daniel. Hi, Laura. I was with the Martones in New Orleans. So very cool to see you here. Thanks also to Tiffany Humfeld, Tracy Curzon Manners, and Kristen Curry. Thank you, all of you, and to everyone supporting the show on Patreon. Like the tweets and emails, it demonstrates you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And you can support the show with just a couple of dollars a month or a couple of coffees a month if you're feeling generous, and you get the extra monthly Q&A audio, including the whole backlist. So you get to ask your questions and I answer them. And there's lots more audio fun if you sign up at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, here's a word from Kobo Writing Life, and then let's get on with the interview.
Hi, I'm Chrissy.
And I'm Stephanie.
And we're from Kobo Writing Life, Kobo's free, fast, and easy self-publishing platform. KWL was built by authors for authors, and our team of dedicated book lovers is always working hard to help authors reach new readers around the world.
Our author-first approach is why we build our promotions tool, an easy and affordable way for you to market your book directly to Kobo readers right in the KWL dashboard. We post Kobo sales happening soon, many of which are exclusive to KWL authors, and you submit your books. We offer lots of promos that don't require you to drop your price because we know it's a pain to coordinate pricing across retailers.
So if that sounds good to you, keep an eye out for percent off promotions and buy more, save more sales, where you can submit your titles and leave the rest to us.
And if you're using free as a marketing strategy, you can submit to be featured on Kobo's free page, which gets a ton of traffic.
If you're a KWL author and don't yet have access to the promotions tool, email us at writinglife@kobo.com and we'll get you sorted. We're all about providing excellent support.
If you want to learn more about KWL, check out our blog, podcast, and find us on social. You can create your free account at kobo.com/writinglife. Back to you, Joanna.
Today, I'm here with Jeff Simon. Hi, Jeff.
Buddy. Hi, Joanna.
It's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. Jeff is a federal forensic investigator and has participated in high-profile cases, including 9/11 and the Iraq War, as well as murder cases and other crimes. He's certified in the collection and preservation of evidence, blood spatter analysis, autopsies, and laboratory techniques. Jeff is also a certified federal polygraph examiner and highly skilled in the psychophysiological detection of deception, which is possible. The best bio I've ever read. So Jeff, tell us a bit more about your background and how you got into this work.
That is actually a story. I get asked that a lot, but it actually fell into my lap. I used to teach forensics at George Washington University. And the number one question I would always get from my students is, how do I get into this? How do I get to do what you do? And hardest question for me to answer, because literally I was in Korea. How many stories start that way? I was in Korea working for the State Department, basically admin, doing filing and that sort of thing. And there was a U.S. Air Force person who died. And when you are somebody who works for the American government and are in that position outside of America, if something happens to you, our government says that you will have an autopsy. Next of kin does not have a say in that. And where they do autopsies in the Asian theater for Americans is Okinawa. And so the remains had to be transported from Korea to Okinawa. And I was the newest one in country. And so I got volunteered, to do that. And so I had to basically escort these remains and be in that autopsy. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be a part of it, but I had to. And the pathologist was really, really good with where I was and with my personality and my hesitation and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And he just would give me little tasks throughout the entire autopsy. And as I did little task, before I knew it, the autopsy was done. I went back to Korea, had my little life. It was fine. And about 6 months later, I got a call from this pathologist. And he said, listen, the government is putting together a specialized forensics program. We're looking for volunteers. You know, we'll send you to school, but then your payback will be time served with the government. Would you be interested? If you put a package together, I'll back it. And I said, sure. And that is my origin story. And when someone asks, well, how can I do what you do? I was like, well, you know, go to Korea. I don't know what to tell them.
Well, but surely it comes from presumably this guy noticed that you weren't freaking out. I mean, you weren't like throwing up in a corner or something. So there must have been something about your character that worked in that situation.
I guess so. I guess because he set it up for me where I was very task oriented during that time, that fit well with what I could handle during that procedure. And, you know, once I actually got into forensics and learned the science and reason behind things, it became much less gory for me. It became much more academic and a job that needed to be done. So if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And I mean, I think that kind of leads me into my next question, which is, you know, we mentioned there in your bio, you were in the 9/11. I mean, that job yep. there was accompanying human remains. I mean, there's an emotional side. I mean, obviously you're doing a job, as you say, but there's an emotional side of working with death, especially in these mass death situations. So how do you practically do your job while still respecting the dead?
So that's another a popular question I get, and how it's mostly phrased to me is, do you have a switch? Do you turn it on and off? How do you deal with the emotions of it? And I was kind of thrown into the deep end of the pool when I started my forensics career, in that my first specialty, my first focus in forensics when I actually started doing investigations, was in the realm of crimes against children. And so it was through those types of cases that I developed the way I approach this very quickly. And that is, you have to look at what you're doing. And I don't want to say that it's a switch that I mean, can turn off my emotions so much, because the emotions are still there and the emotions are valid. And actually, I believe the emotions are needed. But it's a way of looking at the task at hand. So like when I was working with children, the task at hand is these people, these little, you know, young people are a victim here, and I'm the one tasked to help them. And if I'm an emotional mess crying in the corner, I'm not helping them. And so I've got to take my emotions and channel them in a way that I can do my job for them. And then when I started autopsies, it was basically the same thing. I am the last person involved with this person here, with this deceased person. And this is this deceased person's last medical exam. This is this deceased person's chance to get any sort of justice. And if I become emotional about it, I'm not fulfilling that task. And in a way of honoring them, it's channeling those emotions so that you can do your job.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. And of course, a lot of people write books in order to kind of deal with a lot of this stuff, and it brings up emotions. But I wondered about the stereotypes of people who work with death. Now, it's so funny because, you know, you get the kind of creepy bug guy or the goth woman in the corner with the black makeup. And so
listen, you say creepy and goth, I say attractive, you know.
No, I'm with you, and I call myself a vanilla goth, actually, because I'm goth on the inside. What types of people work in the kind of the death arena as such, so we can write more authentic characters? Because I feel like as writers, we do often write these stereotypical people dealing with death.
Yeah, and I think I'm going to answer that two ways, if you don't mind. And the first way is, write them as normal people, because the coroner doing the autopsy is still a mom who has to get to soccer practice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the medical examiner who's trying to deal with the latest mass shooting is also, you know, somebody who is hoping that he gets the date he wants or whatever. So they are legitimately, we are normal people, but also we are people who are able to remain calm in an emergency and are able to do, I guess, what I was talking about before and sort of use our emotions instead of being controlled by our emotions. I think that's how I would answer that.
Mm. So you're basically saying just write normal people. Like, yeah. Do you think there's anything special? Because I think there's something special.
Oh, I think I'm darn special. No, I'm kidding. We're also very funny, if you haven't noticed. Is there anything special? Well, you know, talking about funny, we tend to have a specific sense of humor. I believe if you boil it down, it is sort of a defense mechanism. But we are able to find the humor and the joke in most situations, and probably the more emotional, the more humor is used. And so we may be a little bit more on the morbid side, but we're also not, you know, we don't sleep in the basement, you
know? In the coffin.
Exactly.
Okay. So that's one issue with stereotypes. The other thing, and when I was reading one of your many books about forensics, talking about stereotypes of identifying the body. Now, I thought, because of TV, obviously, that tattoos could be used to identify a body. So what are the real methods of positive identification?
So there are three scientific methods of identifying a body. And when I say scientific, that's what we call having a positive ID. It is scientifically backed, and we can say, therefore, this is this person. And those three methods are DNA, odontology, which are teeth. So you can identify someone through, if you have previous dental records, you can identify them through their teeth, or fingerprints. And those are the only three positive identification methods. Now, can you identify people by other means? You can, but we don't say it as positive. So you can use tattoos, but the problem is a completely different person can go to the same tattoo artist and happen to get the same tattoo in the same area of their body. So how can you say that this is in fact that person? And because of decomposition affects and just different types of states that the bodies can be found in, we no longer rely on visual ID. We no longer rely on like family members coming in to identify the body. Either the body can look different because of decomposition, or the family member can be in an emotional state where they're not seeing what they think they're seeing. And so it's just not reliable. And there are too many misidentifications by using those methods. You can use those methods to help in your identification, but there are only three positive IDs.
So, well, I'm really surprised now, because you said you don't have the family member come in and ID the body, which has to be one of the most regular scenes in films and books.
Well, it's dramatic, right?
Totally dramatic. It's far more dramatic than you entering some little cell into a computer.
Exactly.
So what are the other things that are completely wrong, or that you see and go, oh, that again, in a book or a movie or a film?
Well, you know, it's mostly... if anyone is writing a scene in the morgue, what typically I find the scene is the law enforcement person going to the pathologist to get the update or to talk. And when you go to the morgue, the pathologist is always in the morgue and there are always bodies about. And that's not how it happens. Every doctor that works in a morgue has his or her own office, and that's where they do their meetings. And when they go to the actual morgue part of it, they're there to do the autopsy. And the bodies don't just lie out. The bodies are stored in a refrigerated room that is put away until that those remains are needed. And so you never have a consultation with a law enforcement person over the body.
Everyone's just going, oh my goodness. How can it possibly be dramatic then if there's no body?
Wait, there's no drama in sitting across a desk from someone? I know.
That's crazy. Well, I mean, so in Bones, the TV show, they sometimes have the body in the middle of what looks like the Smithsonian, right? It's in the middle of the whole museum.
Well, let's also remember in Bones, isn't that the show that they have that wonderful holograph image maker thing? Yeah, we haven't quite gotten to that state yet.
Oh, no. So anything else that people regularly get wrong?
Yes, but in most of these situations I bring up, I understand why fiction, you can fudge it a little. And that I'm a firm believer in. Your story is what's important. That's what your readers are buying your books for. And if you need to fudge a little bit, it's totally okay. You don't have to be 1,000% realistic. I say what's more important than realism is consistency. And so if you're going to write it, if this is your world and in your world building, it's not exactly as it is in the real life, that's fine. Just be consistent with it and have it be that way in your world. But then don't claim that you're completely realistic. But my example with that is, you know, you never, let me rephrase that. During an autopsy, we take what we call personal protective equipment very seriously. We cannot chance adding our hairs or whatever as evidence onto the body, but also we need to protect ourselves health-wise and whatnot, because you're dealing with blood and body fluids and whatnot. But on screen, it's very difficult to have your actors with masks on all the time. And so what we typically have on TV shows and movies is, you know, these beautiful actors standing over the body, fixing their hair, doing whatever. And you don't really see that. But I also understand why it is that way, because you need in very short amount of time, each person, the audience to be able to identify what person is doing what. And so, you know, you can fudge it a little bit, but that's not realistic.
No, that makes sense. But if you're writing a novel as opposed to a TV show, you can definitely put on some protective equipment. And in fact, you know, a little off topic, but I've just read The Hot Zone by Richard Preston about Ebola and a whole load of people doing autopsies on monkeys and stuff. And it was just, it was so scary.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you take that protection very seriously.
Yeah, I imagine.
In the real world. Yeah,
definitely. So you know, a lot of writers, you speak a lot of writers things, and you have some great examples of decomposition, the difference between a zombie and a mummy. And a lot of people now will have zombies and mummies in their heads. So using those examples, can you talk a bit about decomposition?
I can. The three main characters you see in fiction that relate directly back to decomposition are, you said two of them, zombies and mummies and vampires. And how we view each of those different creatures literally has a direct path back to actual decomposition. Vampires, for example, we often visualize as very white-faced, and sometimes with black veins. And that is that comes from an early stage of decomposition. When the blood seeps out of your arteries and veins, you become quite pale. And that's typically depicted with having a white face. And as the decomposition starts, the one major factor of decomposition is the bacteria in your body. As the blood leaves the veins and arteries, those become passageways for the bacteria. And as they are leaving their waste behind, it darkens the veins. And that's where you get those black veins for vampires. Zombies and mummies tend to be on opposite end of the spectrums for different types of decomposition. Decomposition really is environmentally based, whether it's a wet environment or a dry environment, a cold environment or a hot environment, whether it changes environments because somebody moves the body. All of those have a great effect on the rate and type of decomposition. So when you're thinking about a zombie, how they're typically depicted are green and squishy and whatnot. And that is a pretty valid depiction of a later stage normal decomposition. The body changes color, typically greenish color, until it ultimately turns more like a blackish color. And it's very wet. But in mummification, and when I say mummification, I don't mean the Egyptian procedure of taking out the organs, whatnot. It's literally called mummification as a stage in decomposition. It's a very arid, a very dry environment in which the moisture is out of the air. And because the moisture is out of the air, the bacteria can't go, you can't function or live as well as in a normal, I say normal environment, but as in an environment we're used to. And so mummies tend to be more brown and brittle instead of squishy, if you will. And we see that when you depict them in fiction. And so I love that they each of these have sort of their base in an actual decomposition.
Which is pretty cool. Like, are there any other creatures made up of the stages of decomposition?
I'd have to think about that for a minute. I'm not sure. I'll get back to that one.
One could ask the a more supernatural question. I mean, you know, in terms of ghosts and do you feel like the dead body is a dead body and it's gone? There is no person left. Do you feel like there, or have you experienced any kind of supernatural or ghost-like encounters?
I haven't had any personal extra experiences like that, but I feel like, how do I answer that? I feel like I treat all remains as with respect. I guess that's how I want to say that. Mm-hmm. I think there are various beliefs throughout the world on what happens to a person after death. And some beliefs are the eternal soul is linked to the condition of the body. Some beliefs are once the person's dead, that their essence is elsewhere and the vessel no longer is that person. And there's sort of everything in between. And I think that remains need to be treated with respect, just so that everybody is honored, if you will, and all beliefs are honored. And I think we find that at least in the United States, all of my experience forensically is United States, just to make that clear. But, if we have a body that is unidentified, or better yet, unclaimed, so you can't find next of kin, or the next of kin just outright refuses to take responsibility for the body, you know, what do we do with those bodies? And, you know, a body is released to a mortuary and they normally release it to a funeral home. But what if you don't have that permission or even know what the family would wish for that body? Mm-hmm. Well, the counties or states all have laws in that any unclaimed remains will either be buried or cremated and buried by that county or state. So they still respect the remains. And I have the sort of the same outlook on that there is a respect involved.
Mm. Well, I think the other thing I was thinking of then is in America, from what I've read, embalming is very common, whereas in the UK, certainly, it's not very common at all. It's just not something people do. So, you know, when we're thinking about, and, you know, many of the listeners are crime writers or, so if someone, you know, and there's often the scene of digging up the remains to do some test and, you know, in Britain, that will be a decomposed body. Whereas in America, is that true about embalming, and does embalming, for example, get rid of evidence or keep evidence, or what would be that difference?
So, there are exhumations in the United States, but what I was going to say is one of the steps in an autopsy is to take samples of every tissue and organ, for storage. And that is strictly the entire purpose is if you need to do tests later on, you would have the actual tissue preserved and whatnot for that purpose. Embalming slows down decomposition greatly, but it doesn't stop it. And so when, if we were to do an exhumation, even here in the United States on remains that have been embalmed, they are not in pristine condition from that point on. It's just greatly slowed.
Yeah, so it's so interesting. And I mean, again, coming back to the mummies, you've traveled in Europe, right?
Yes.
So there's a lot of sites in Europe, you know, Italy particularly, of skeletons and mummied monks and things in catacombs and crypts and things. So is that, I mean, the mummification but that can happen in a natural environment as well, right?
Absolutely. The whole deal with mummification is the arid conditions of when the body is going through its decomposition. And decomposition is typically furthered by that bacteria that's inside of us. And in a very, very dry, moisture-less environment, that bacteria dies out and is unable to go through that decomposition process. And so what you have is a very brittle result. But even though the body, the skin and the organs and the bones and whatnot are very brittle, they're really well preserved because they're not being eaten away as we would think in normal conditions. And so that is why you can see these mummies throughout the world on exhibit, because the drying out process has actually preserved that body.
Yeah.
But they all look withered because there's no moisture. They literally are withered.
Mm. Yeah, very cool. Okay, so back on the fictionalized stuff, because
I
loved the examples that you had of the different autopsies by genre. So I wondered if you'd give us a couple of examples of those, because they are brilliant.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. When I write my books, my books are literally a series called Forensics for Fiction, because my goal is to help out authors. And so when I'm writing about a particular topic, I want all authors to know that, hey, this could apply to you as well. And so when you think of an autopsy, you know, a police procedural is a pretty common genre that you would expect to find those in. But autopsies could be in really any genre. I like to use the example for, you know, a thriller. In any sort of contagion type storyline, or even the Da Vinci Code, an autopsy is very important to start that clock, that ball rolling in the thriller. So you can think of that there, but you can use an autopsy in romance or a more emotion filled story. Death is a very emotional experience. And, you know, depending on how you're writing, I don't know, you could have your main character question why she's flirting with the doctor when she should be mourning her husband. I don't know.
Mourning evil husband.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. But you can have autopsies in paranormal. How does your paranormal character have a different anatomy, and how does that affect your autopsy? You can have autopsies in science fiction and fantasy for the same reason. Is this an alien creature, or is technology different? And in historicals, how was the autopsy done back in that era? And was religion more of a factor back then? Were the tools limiting back then? So I think that you can really apply it in any genre to work through either furthering the story technically or furthering the story emotionally.
Mm. Yeah, it was just reminding me, there's this very creepy thing in Europe where they put bells on coffins that linked down into the grave, because, of course, they didn't have the technology. So sometimes people were buried alive. And, of course, you don't want to be buried alive. So the historical stuff is fascinating, but I loved the sort of anatomy of a goblin, which is brilliant. I've never read the anatomy of a goblin in a goblin autopsy.
Very few people have, and so plot bunny.
Yeah, no, it's such a good idea. So anyone who's read my fiction will know I'm particularly obsessed with medical specimens and human body parts in jars. I have in a lot of my books, and the history, talking about history, the medical history is fascinating. I was in Philadelphia, went to the Mutter Museum which is fantastic, right? Really fascinating. So obviously you've talked about respect, and that's taken as a given, but what are your thoughts on anatomy museums, the physical body being used after death for research?
I, like I said, I think respect is important, but I don't think that using a body for scientific or just plain basic educational needs has to necessarily mean that you're not being respectful. I think it's incredibly important for us to continually learn and to understand what happens to our bodies so that we can understand what needs to be done to help us while we're still alive, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I don't have a problem with that. I think we do that when we're alive anyway. If somebody develops a new medication, they go through all these trials and they ask for your consent to go through these trials, understanding that, you know, this may help, there may be side effects. We don't know yet. This is all for experimentation. And I think it's the same idea with someone who's passed. The only problem is they are no longer present for the consent part. But many people get around that by having the consent be done prior to the person passing. And so I feel like if you are doing it in a respectful manner, I'm for it. I think it's beneficial. It's interesting if you go into the history of autopsies, they didn't always follow the respect rule and often were referred to as butchers because that's sort of what it was. The earlier people studying anatomy did it because they were curious or morbid or whatever, but I don't think that they were really considering the consent side of things. But I don't think it has to be that way. I think it can definitely be respectful and still beneficial scientifically.
Mm. Well, I was just thinking that criminals often used after hanging here in Britain, the Hunterian Museum is full of criminals or supposed criminals, who knows? But yep. It is fascinating. Now, I also wanted, there are so many things I wanted to ask you, and you've got a book on blood spatter as well, which is particularly cool. But I do want to ask you about the polygraph side, because that really caught my eye. It seems to me that the polygraph side of your work is completely different to your other stuff, the kind of forensic stuff. So why the polygraph side as well?
Well, because my entire career has been in law enforcement and has been sort of on the scientific side of law enforcement. And that is the next scientific endeavor that I entered. I should be clear that I don't do all of this at once.
Because you can't really do one on a dead person.
Right, exactly. But I was involved with autopsies when I held a position with the Armed Forces Medical Examiner's Office. And so that's specifically what we did was autopsies. Mm-hmm. I am no longer in that position. And now I go to crime scenes, I deal with preservation of evidence, and I do interviews. And in the interview side of my job is where I was afforded the opportunity to get certified and become a polygrapher. And so I don't want you thinking that, you know, all specialties are one person does all specialties at all times. It depends on what job you have and what your focus is. But the reason I looked into polygraph and then ended up going to the school and becoming certified is because it's a scientific technique used in the investigation of criminals. And so that's what I did.
and again, I mean, it seems to me another one of those things that there's so many, again, all of us think in our heads, you know, of the person sitting in the room with the thing around their arm and someone pressing buttons or whatever. I mean, again, right. Are there any issues with the way that type of thing is portrayed?
Oh, sure. Oh, absolutely. When most people think of polygraph, they think of you know, daytime TV and who your baby daddy. And I will just say there are different types of polygraph tests. And it is a valid science that is over dramatized greatly in popular thinking.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. When I think I just found that fascinating. I mean, is the thread for your work, it's all solving the crime, basically.
Correct, yes.
Yeah, which is fantastic. Right, so tell us about the other books or all of your books in the forensic series so everyone knows what you have.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah, so I started this series called Forensics for Fiction. And how that sort of came about was I live with a writer. I was constantly being asked, well, how would this work? Or how long does someone need to be poisoned before? Or if I was going to dispose of the body? And so I got used to answering those questions. And as he would then travel and go to his different conferences or talk to other writers, I would get more questions from more writers. And it didn't take me a lot of research to discover that there were sort of two ends of the spectrums if a writer wanted to do research. You could either get the really technical, like school book version of it, which is really hard to read and slog through, or you could get a kind of fluff piece that sort of didn't really touch on much of what was realistic or how things were done, but basically just sort of barely glazed over a lot of it. And I found very few books that had that median of it was accessible on one side, but realistic and technical enough on the other. And that's what started the idea of my Forensics for Fiction series. And that's literally what it is. I'm trying to take the realism of what I do, what my partners and other agents do in real life, and make it accessible for the writer so that they understand what the realism is, but better yet, decide what works for their story. Mm. Because again, I don't believe that all stories have to be 1,000% realistic. If you're going to be 1,000% realistic, then you're going to have the cop talking to the pathologist across the desk. And again, I don't know how dramatic that is. And so, but I want to provide a platter that you as authors can pick from for what works for your story and give it a base that is absolutely based in realism. So that's how that started. And my first book was Blood Spatter. And from there, I wrote my book on crime scenes. And then I did autopsies. The next one that will come out will be on arson. And so, yeah.
Interesting. And will you be doing anything on polygraphy and deception? Or is that just going to give people too many tips?
Well, yeah, I was joking with you a little bit about before this interview. And there is a line, actually. There is a line of how realistic am I comfortable with you all being? And then at what point does your fiction become a instruction manual for an actual criminal? So I figure that out for myself, and then I present it to you all. But if there's a real if there's a genuine interest in any subtopic of forensics or investigation, I'm more than open to either talking about it or if there's enough material writing about it. Sure.
I think my interest in that deception side is because I think that most fiction writers are, well, we're liars. We lie and we make things up for a living. So I guess I'm just really interested in the psychology of people who make stuff up. I don't know if you have any thoughts on whether like we'd be much better at polygraph tests than people who aren't so imaginative.
Well, yes and no. The deal with polygraph is its entire premise, its scientific base is based on something internally. You guys don't have to remember this, but it's called the autonomic nervous system, which is something that we can't control with our brain. They are physical responses that occur separate from our cognitive thought. And because they're sort of automatic and we can't control them, that is where the polygraph comes in, and it's monitoring those reactions within your body. So even well-versed liars, you know, still can't control the reactions they have with inside their body. But to sort of take a sharp left turn here real quick, I think what I would say for people writing that is the same thing that I say about people writing crime scenes. And that is, if you want to write about lying or solving a crime, the best way to do that is to figure out how you're going to resolve that issue before you get into writing the issue itself. Mm-hmm. And when I'm talking about crime scenes, I say solve your crime before you commit it, because what most the trap that most authors fall into is they have an exciting idea about a crime scene. You've never heard about this crime scene before. I've got the best idea ever. And they're writing it and they're writing it and they're writing it and they're writing it. And they make the evidence very vague because they don't want it solved in chapter two. They need a whole book worth of investigations and they're great, they're great, they're great. And they get to the second to last chapter and they're like, now I've got to solve it. How do I solve it? And so they open themselves up to logic leaps because they haven't peppered their story with the evidence that's actually there so that the reader can look back and say, oh. And so if you solve it first, if you know what your smoking gun is before you do the actual crime, then you can write your story in the direction of that smoking gun. And same thing with deception. If you know how they're going to get caught in their lie, then you can work that lie in so that you can craft it so that it's a humdinger of a lie, but it's not a logic leap for them to get caught later on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah. And I must say, I mean, I this interview was mainly about the autopsy one. But your books are, like you say, detailed technically, but not so detailed that they're not really readable. Like I really enjoyed.
Thank you.
Yeah, I really enjoyed zoomed through the autopsy book. I was just like, oh, this is so cool. And there's a lot of ideas. So I'd love people to check that out. Also, you speak around the world at many writers' conferences. So we met at NINC, which was really cool. So if anyone listening sees your name, then they should definitely go. But where can people find you and your books online?
Oh, thank you so much for that. I am everywhere online, and luckily nobody has my name yet. So if you look up Jeff Simon, Jeff with a G, Simon with a Y, you should be able to find me. But my website is jeffsimon.com, and the website that goes to my books, which is part of my main website, is forensicsforfiction.com. Mm-hmm. All of my books are sold on all the major areas. If you want to go Amazon, iTunes, Barnes & Noble, wherever, you should be able to find them there as well.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Jeff. That was great.
Well, thank you for having me. This was great. It really was fun.
So I hope you enjoyed the interview with Jeff today. I particularly love his ideas about writing autopsy scenes in fantasy books. It's just brilliant. And Jeff has a wonderful series of forensic for fiction writer books, so definitely check those out. So next week, I'm interviewing Ruth Ware, a business-minded, traditionally published author, about her thoughts on self-editing as super important for writing a manuscript that sells, as well as intellectual property, the importance of reading your contracts, and why you are always a freelancer, even if you get a publishing deal. It's a great, insightful interview with Ruth. That's coming next week. So happy writing, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes and show notes, available at thecreativepen.com/podcast. You can also get your free author blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.